Takes three to make a trend story, right? Yeah, well, let's hope the economic trend is wrong, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today, the 28th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, let's see. Where should we begin today? Stocks down 1% or so across the board. The major indices selling off into the close, always a troubling sign. Or bonds, maybe. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note falling to a near 2-year low, a sign sometimes of wilting investor confidence. Or housing, perhaps, where we are obliged to note today that the housing slowdown is officially a year old. Actually, a little bit more than a year now, given the lag that comes with collecting and analyzing all that data. According to the latest Case-Shiller National Home Price Index out today, home prices were up 3.7% in March. Yes, up, that is, growth, but the 12th straight month of slower price growth. And that, for people looking to sell, can make the whole process of setting the asking price even more challenging, because cutting later often does come with a cost. Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going.
When I first spoke to Nancy McInerney a few months ago, she was struggling to sell her 4-bedroom house in Aberdeen, Maryland. She'd listed it at $399,000 in January. 4 months and 2 price cuts later, she finally sold it last month for $375,000.
It hurt, but I just wanted out of there. Honestly.
As the housing market nationally continues to cool, more people are knocking down their asking price. According to Zillow, in April, about 15% of listings had a price cut. That's up from 12% a year ago. Zillow's Director of Economic Research, Skylar Olson, says a price cut does bump a house to the top of search results.
More buyers might experience your listings that way.
But their experience might be negative.
You get a bit of the taste of the lemon, you know, in your mouth, in the sense of, oh, there's something about this home that's not selling.
And typically, the longer a house sits on the market, the lower the final price. Taylor Marr is a senior economist with Redfin. He says a listing gets more than 3 times as many views when it's first posted than after a price cut.
So it's definitely more advantageous to price your home right the first time.
Lisa Lynn did what you're supposed to and worked with a local broker who knew the market. She listed her home in suburban Chicago for $389,000 in March, then dropped the price twice before accepting an offer for $357,000.
Could we have set the price lower? I guess. And then if we had sold that first weekend, we would wonder, well, could we have gotten more for it?
In the end, Lynn sold the house for $20,000 less than she paid for it in 2007. Now she's renting. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you really stop to think about it, there is probably no key slice of this economy with a bigger long-term upside than payments. Companies that take your money and help banks get that money where it belongs. There was a big acquisition today in payments, is why I say that, $21 billion big. Two companies you probably never heard of, but which have almost certainly had their hands on your money, Global Payments and TSYS by name. Payment companies are, kind of by definition, behind the scenes as far as consumers are concerned, but the idea that they are merging, and a lot of them are, says a lot about how the way we pay for things is changing. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on that one.
When you buy something at, like, a restaurant or convenience store, there's some program or system that takes your money.
Your total is $3.39. System processing.
And you'd think it would be pretty simple, but actually there are multiple companies involved. One company takes your money, another company helps your credit card move your money, another company might make sure the money gets into the restaurant's bank account.
They're really sort of the back end of the payments industry.
Andrew Davidson is with Mintel Comper Media. These companies, this industry, has been on a merger and acquisition bender, absorbing smaller companies, merging with bigger ones.
This is the third merger announcement this year, in which the value of the transactions exceeds $20 billion.
There's two things going on here. First, more payments are being done online or in apps, and newcomers like Square or Stripe are gobbling up that business right out from under the noses of traditional payment processors.
They're starting to feel the pain of Silicon Valley.
Deborah Baxley is with Paygility Advisors, a payments consultancy.
Any app where you're paying in the app, like with Uber or Lyft, that's the business they want to get in. They want to be embedded in those apps to process those payments, not just restaurant payments or whatever.
Second, merging is a way for traditional payment companies to make more money.
In a mature market like the United States, the expectation for further growth in card payments is really just in single digits.
David Robertson is publisher of the Nilson Report newsletter. If you merge, you save money, you make money. In the case of TSYS and Global Payments, they say they're going to save $300 million a year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday, that's really a Monday. As I said, not bad, then bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back a couple of months ago, late March it was, we went over to the UK to talk about the economic reality of the political mess that is Brexit. Since then, well, the politics is more messy. Prime Minister Theresa May has announced her resignation. The no-deal Brexit party dominated the European Parliament elections this past weekend. So businesses in the UK still do have a whole lot of unknowns. We got Samantha Wallace on the phone to talk about it. We talked to her back in March in her honey selling stall in London's Borough Market. Samantha, it's good to speak with you again.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So tell me, we were there in March-ish. How has business been the past couple of months at the Borough Market?
Well, touch wood, it's been very good, I have to say. It's been quite mild and it's been very busy with lots of visitors from, well, the UK and abroad. So it seems to be that business is on track, but I'm touching wood as we speak because I don't want to jinx it.
Well, I hate to be the one to bring the jinx, but I have to bring the politics into this. You know, when we were there and we were chit-chatting that day at the Borough Market, you were not hopeful, shall we say, about your prospects given what's going on. And now it's just more confusing.
It's very confusing because it just seems to be an ongoing kind of scary, awful deja vu that just won't go away. So we're more confused than we were when we met in March, I think.
Well, so let's get down to brass tacks. You said at the time that you were still importing lots of honey from European vendors. You're still doing that? Are you stockpiling at all? I remember we had a whole conversation about how tough honey is to store. You just run out of room.
Yeah, we're still trying to stockpile, but the problem is we have very limited storage space, so we can kind of stockpile around 3 to 6 months worth, but not in everything. So we have to kind of cherry pick what we think is going to be popular, or try and second guess what the season is doing. So at the moment, we're trying to guess the acacia season in Italy to work out if we're going to be short in Italy for that line of honey and if we need to source it from somewhere else. And now with Brexit on top of everything, which, because this is a genuine seasonal problem every year, there's always something. But it's just, where do we source it from? Do we try the EU? Do we go outside the EU? It's not helpful on the decision-making front.
If you wanted to source outside the European Union, could you? I mean, can you get enough of what you need to make that viable?
Yes, I think so. I think we could. But for us, there is certain standards around quality, how it's produced, if it's going to be of consistent quality, but it's also harvested in the right way. The way we work is very slow. So we don't want, you know, large importers or producers who are just kind of mass producing honey. We're looking for the kind of the different person, the person who may not put themselves necessarily so forward to do business. And that takes time. So it's partly language barriers, time to find people and then develop those relationships.
So on the way out, let me just ask you one last political question. And
sure.
It goes like this. The next deadline, near as I read the papers, is October the 31st. There is now the much stronger tendency toward a possibly hard or no deal Brexit at the end of that time. What's that going to mean for you?
I have to say, I think that would be disastrous. I mean, we are a tiny business who are so aided by having just-in-time logistics with Europe and these kind of no borders. I mean, we try and do things in the best faith, but we're not experts. And there's a lot of frightening talk about needing to employ customs agents and things being delayed and the extra costs. So not only with the extra tariffs in terms of taxes that would suddenly apply, to pay then customs agents would, I mean, really cost us a fortune. So it would just really change the model of our business, and that would definitely put our future into jeopardy.
Samantha Wallace, she is the owner with her husband, right? Your husband's Italian, right? Do I remember that right?
He is, yes. Yeah. It's a great advantage, you see, with the Italian honeys, is having an Italian husband, it has to be said. So,
that's right.
Yeah, if we drop out, it's going to be interesting.
That's right. Samantha Wallace, she and her husband, the owners of From Field and Flower. It's a honey shop in the Borough Market in London. Samantha, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, more trade of a global nature. Vice President Pence is headed to Canada on Thursday to talk new NAFTA. They're having elections up there this fall, eh? That'll complicate things. There is no shortage of trade news in this economy or on this program, specifically news of trade with China and how it's going or not. But over there in China, the state-run media is tight-lipped, shall we say, about trade and a whole lot of other stuff, which is why a new social media account is getting a whole lot of attention. Tauron Notes, it's called, and it does seem to have an inside track on Beijing's thinking in the trade talks. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has more.
Tauron Notes publishes news articles on the popular WeChat app. There was an article in January that described the trade talks led by U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Chinese Vice Premier Liu He. And our news assistant Charles Zhang noticed something unusual.
It's this sentence. It says Lighthizer was very nervous and almost silent, and Liu He had a natural facial expression.
Natural facial expressions. What does that mean?
It means Liu He is more relaxed, maybe confident even.
The public rarely gets this kind of detail from state-run media. David Bendersky is with the China Media Project.
Information gets people excited in China.
Because here, news is censored, especially about tariffs, which can lead to some murky coverage on Chinese state TV. Like earlier this month when President Donald Trump tweeted that he would increase tariffs on Chinese products again. The state media ignored the news until the end of the trading day. Here's Shanghai's Financial TV Yi Cai's evening broadcast.
We start with some breaking news. On May 6th, the foreign ministry held a press conference, and a journalist asked about President Donald Trump's statement to add additional tariffs on Chinese products.
She reads the foreign ministry response in full, and then the news abruptly turns back to the top story. Stock markets slump between 5.6% and 7%.
Due to the impact of some external factor, the stock markets in Shanghai and Shenzhen both saw big drops today.
Yes, external factor. She's careful not to link the stock market drop directly to President Trump's tariff threats. Economic news is more regulated than ever before. Small investors like Huang Shengjun have noticed he doesn't even trust research notes from economists.
The China Securities Regulatory Commission held a meeting last year with chief economists from funds and brokerage firms. The meeting was called a seminar, but it was actually to tell chief economists to be careful of what they write.
In fact, after that meeting, the economists signed a pledge to, quote, positively guide market expectations. Under this heavy censorship, Tauron Notes is unique. When President Trump made good on his threat to boost tariffs, it wrote, if you want to talk, talk. If you want to fight, fight. So, who's behind this account? Investor Huang Shengjun has a theory.
Since its articles were reprinted by the official media, the account should be run by some editor-in-chief from a state news outlet, or at least someone with a government title.
But even if Tauron Notes does have state backing, why would the government under President Xi Jinping do it? Again, Chinese media analyst David Bendersky.
We have under Xi Jinping controls to an extent we have not seen at any period in the reform era. And yet China is more enmeshed with the world. Its people demand real information because this is the information on which they base investment and business and the future.
He says Tauron Notes may be the government experimenting with new ways to put out information.
Without rocking the boat, and without really owning up to it, in a sense.
He says anyone who wants to know the Communist Party's official line on trade talks with the U.S. should stick to the People's Daily newspaper. Although China's system is so opaque, you really can't know for sure. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
coming up.
Middle of the road in my ratings, I wrote good Android.
Cheap phones or not cheap phones? That is the question. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 237 today, 0.9%, 25,347. The NASDAQ down 29 points, 0.4%, 76.07. The S&P 500 down 23 points, 0.8%, 28.02 at the close there. Told you about that big acquisition. Global Payments is buying TSYS. TSYS banked 4.7% on the news. Global Payments down 3% today. Memorial Day, the unofficial beginning of summer. For lots of people, that means theme parks. SeaWorld Entertainment up 16% today. That stock, by the way, now up almost 40%, 40% since the beginning of the year. Six Flags gained 1.6%. Beyond Meat, which went public a couple of weeks ago, gained 8% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, as I alluded to, fell to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood. On the Marketplace Tech Podcast, we give you a daily smart take on the digital economy, from cybersecurity around local elections to how your television might give you personalized ads. We help you better understand the tech that impacts your life and your work. Join me every weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did a thing on the growing business of customized products not too long ago. Getting your shampoo, just for instance, tailored to your head of hair, vitamins that target your specific needs. Also, custom-designed sports drinks, Gatorade among them. Brett O'Brien is the general manager of Gatorade. We got him in to talk about this. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. It's great.
Gatorade is trying to become a science company, kind of. I mean, that's the gist, right?
Yeah. I dare say we've been a science company for quite some time. You know, if you think about how we started back at the University of Florida, it was literally a scientist who said, I think I can help these guys, you know, last a little bit longer on the field, especially in the fourth quarter. And so we've got a whole wing of our business called the Gatorade Sports Science Institute, and it's all science-based, and it's all how do we make sure we drive performance.
And you're working on these GX pods, and you've got sweat patches, and figure out how salty your sweat is and what you need to replenish, all of which, more power to you. But let me ask you this. Yeah. It's one thing for you guys to be doing this for somebody in the NFL or women's professional soccer or whatever. Mm-hmm. Here I am, middle-aged neighborhood dad out, and, you know, I run 4 miles a day. Do I need this?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to build up your ability to do that four-mile loop quicker, faster, stronger, then, yeah, you probably do. And so that's where all these pods and the system of GXI and personalization comes into play.
I'm going to assume, I don't know, but I'm going to assume that Gatorade Sports Science Institute is a huge investment by your parent company, PepsiCo. What's the marginal gain here, right? Are you getting the me's of the world to buy this product?
You know what? I think where the marginal gain comes in is the future of where we go. Like, how do we make sure that we stay one step ahead of athletes? So if truly function is what will drive business in the future, it's what will nail athletes, what gets them better, then that's where we have to be. And we can't get to function unless we understand the science and understand athletes better than anybody else. And that's where personalization come into play. Now, not everybody's going to engage in a personalized Gatorade. It's just the reality is people are going to choose the Gatorade that they like to choose. And you may choose it just based on the color. You may choose it based
green.
On the flavor.
Always green.
That's fine.
Always.
And that's great if that works for you. If you want more, we will be able to supply you with more.
So play this out for me. Where could this conceivably go as ever more people want ever more personalization?
Yeah. You could get to a world where you're a coach and you're on the sidelines and you would understand the hydration level of every athlete on your team.
Oh, because so you'd be looking at it not like on your tablet
you
or something,
got it.
Right?
So it will connect to your tablet. We'll have smart bottles that will literally tell you who's drinking and who's not. And so you'll know it'll help with injury prevention. It'll help with your ability on the field to react.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I don't want to be a Luddite here, but this is And you know, I'm mixing metaphors, but it's a little bit like instant replay, right? I mean, you're getting it down to such a fine line that you take out you know, people just going out there on the field and giving it a try.
There is that, yeah. But if you can think about the idea of injury prevention and dehydration mm-hmm. as a factor, you know, there's a, I don't know if you're how familiar you are with Australian rules football,
vaguely.
But the amount of technology and statistics that they run through that league is far beyond anything we do in the United States. And their ability to understand how much ground you can track when you're hydrated versus when you're dehydrated is awesome. And so the more that we can help, especially at the youth level with dehydration and coaches understanding who needs it, that's massive.
Do you understand the rules for Australian rules football?
Well, I've watched it enough that I'm slowly getting there, yeah.
Brett O'Brien, General Manager at Gatorade. Brett, thanks a lot.
Awesome. Thank you.
Google came out with its latest smartphone a couple of weeks ago, the cheap-ish, at $400, Pixel 3a. A lot of brands are going down market, Nokia, Motorola, a bunch of Chinese companies that already dominate much of the global mobile market. So maybe there's not too much difference anymore among all these phones. Or is there? One expert threw down a challenge to our Scott Tong that Scott could not tell the difference in a blind phone test. Well, challenge accepted.
So, what kind of place even does a phone test? Where could I find all the newest models and try them out?
I'm Avi Greengart. I'm the founder and lead analyst at Techxponential.
Consult in Avi Greengart's office, Teaneck, New Jersey. He has hundreds of phones, old ones, new ones, market failures.
Here's the Galaxy Note 7. It might explode! Of course, it's sitting on the Amazon Fire. There's a little visual pun.
He's lined up 8 phones with the logos taped over for 5 volunteer testers. Dina Likens, politician, Valerie Levin, homemaker, Michael Anthony, campaign manager, Aliza Fishman, public relations pro, and me, Scott Tong. Our challenge, could we identify the phones in the $200 to the $400 range compared to the pricey ones?
When we talk about $1,000 phones, those aren't the only options. And we're curious to find out whether people who aren't phone geeks, will you be able to tell the difference?
It's like a blind wine testing, but it's going to be hard. They all look the same, black rectangles, thin. The Androids all run the same software. We each get 5 minutes to sample a phone. Walk around, test it indoors, outdoors, low light settings. Try the apps, like YouTube music videos. We go together. Better than birds of a feather. Snap a photo. Here's Aliza.
The Nightscape feature on that phone. Even when I went into a dark room, it was able to optimize the photo.
Rank the display. This is Dina.
I like the way the screen, it almost wraps around the whole phone. The whole front of the phone is the screen.
And judge the overall look and feel. Michael.
It's just the outside design just seemed more flimsy.
We give every phone a score, guess the price, and move on to the next one. And in the end, a clear favorite emerges. Phone number 2.
The camera is just so much better than any of the other ones I've done so far.
Oh, yeah.
It was very obvious for me to see where the voice-to-text function was, which is a huge thing for me.
I thought that the image on the videos and the pictures were neat.
And the price is?
Over $1,000. This is Huawei's P30 Pro.
Huawei is the Chinese company the U.S. government has just sanctioned on grounds of being a security threat.
Huawei is not sold in the United States, but the P series is selling tens of millions of units in China and in Europe.
Avi Greengart has one because the phone makers send them to analysts for review. Now, our least favorite phone is Phone 4, surely much lower priced, we think.
It was the worst phone ever. It's $200.
Okay.
I also wrote, I don't like it. Difficult to navigate, okay. But it was pretty.
I could put $300. It's very heavy.
And?
That is the iPhone XR, $750.
So we missed that. And there was one more surprise. Phone number 8, we figured, was right in the middle, maybe $400, $500.
The one thing that I wrote into the camera is that it doesn't seem to have many features.
Middle of the road in my ratings, I wrote good Android.
So it seemed like it would be probably the higher end of cheaper phones.
Okay.
And it's Motorola's G7. It's a $300 phone.
Cheapest in the lineup. It would be our group's $2 chuck bargain. Again, consultant Avi Greengart.
this was one of the ones that was interesting to me as an analyst to find out just how good inexpensive phones have gotten.
At least in our quick, unscientific sample. We couldn't test battery life or data storage, for instance, just first impressions. Even so, next time you're phone shopping, you may as well try them all. And cover up the price tag. In Teaneck, New Jersey, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a Venn diagram of sorts of the art world and computer aficionados. A 2008 Samsung laptop infected with six of the most malicious viruses known to computing has been sold at auction for $1.345 million. The thing has been apparently air-gapped, that is, had all its possible points of internet connectivity sealed up, as it were. But still, right? All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 237 points today, about 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 29 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 dropped 23 points, 0.8%. The 10-year Treasury yield, 2.26% today. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Bion, Danielle Chiriguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Neves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.